everybody. Welcome to episode 676 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Valiant Sunday episode, and I'm going to be continuing the chronology with Harbinger number 7. We have a bit of a different creative team this time. We still have Joshua Dysart on the writing and the scripting. You know, this is pretty much Josh's baby, so I really wouldn't have it any other way. But we do have a few different artists on the title this time, and it gives it a bit of a different look, kind of a softer look in a way. You know, I've always been a big fan of both of these guys, actually. So we have art from Barry Kitson and Lee Garbett, and Kari Evans has a few pages as well. Color art by Ian Hannon with Dan Brown. Lettering by Rob Steen. So we saw last time when we covered one of my favorite issues of Harbinger ever, maybe my favorite issue of the entire run, that Chris had convinced Pete to fight back, and Faith is along for the ride. She feels like they're doing superheroic things, and her aspiring to be a superhero, of course, she's along for the way. So we saw Chris sort of double-cross. Maybe double-cross is not the right word, but set up Toya Harada, right? So she shows up at the house of Chris's parents, and Chris has a laptop set up. She films Harada flying through the air. Clearly, he's more than what he seems, and she thinks that she's going to be able to use that footage to keep herself safe. Harada seems to think otherwise and tells Chris that she's in way over her head. But then we see the house explode, as not only did Chris convinced Harada that Pete was going to be there, but also PRS. So we back up just a few minutes here as this issue starts, issue 7, and we see Project Rising Spirit troops heading towards Pittsburgh, and the troops are going over the plan. Pete Stanchek is supposed to be in this residential home. The tip comes from his ex-girlfriend. They should have the element of surprise. And as soon as we get there, Air Support's going to take out the structure, and they're going to engage. So we see that as this first page unfolds. There's some missiles fired from a helicopter, and they basically hit the house. The house explodes, and that's the panel we saw at the end of last issue. So the ground troops are ready to move in, and as they do, their mouths drop open. They say, "Mother of God," because it's not Pete Stanchek, this untrained Psyot who they've actually attacked. It's Toyo Harada. So we see these troops in their helmets, which I think the helmets are supposed to help with Pete's psionic screams, but they don't help against Harada. We see these troops literally just come apart. It's a crazy image to see them literally start falling into pieces, their entire bodies just being unmade. We turn the page, and we see Toyo Harada there, floating in the fire and the debris of this airstrike, and his eyes are glowing. He's protecting himself and obviously his team who is there with him. And he says, "Chris Hathaway set us up." Fascinating. You know, the level of power that Toyo Harada has, both as a Psyot, that's you know, that knowledge is secret and kept from the general public, but still, he hasn't been challenged on that level by anyone in a really long time. And then when you think about the level of power he has that's public, right? This head of this corporation, this philanthropist, worldwide respect, all the money, in the, you know, richest guy in the world. He's not used to people challenging him and telling him no and that he can't have his way. So I'm sure that's a lot of why he's so fascinated by the fact that here's this kid who's willing to stand up to him. So we fast forward to 1 week later. We're at the Harada Global Conglomerates building in downtown Pittsburgh. It's currently under quote-unquote renovation. And obviously, we know it's actually under repair from the fight that broke out when Pete escaped. So Harada's on a call. He's asking why he was unaware of Project Rising Spirit's movements. And we don't see the response or hear the response from whoever he's on the line with. But he says, "You know, I didn't call to hear excuses. I called to deliver my position, and now's not the time for my contacts to become unreliable. No one wants another Harbinger War. Put your house in order." So clearly, Harada and Project Rising Spirit have some sort of tacit agreement, or if not that, then Harada must have somebody high up in the Project Rising Spirit organization where he expects to be made aware of things like that. Project Rising Spirit attack on that house that where they thought they were attacking Peter, but ultimately they were attacking Harada. So As he hangs up the call, Ingrid appears. She's apologizing for the intrusion. Harada wants to know what news she brings. And Ingrid, before she says anything, gives the news, says, well, should I continue or do you already know? And Harada says, you know, our organization isn't under martial law. I'm not going to invade your thought space. So if I don't have a reason to, so just, it's just intuition. So go on. You know, what do you have to tell me? And Ingrid says, well, last night, Pete Stanchek, Chris Hathaway, and Faith Hebert followed Rachel Hobson. Now, Rachel Hobson is the one who's in charge of recruitment and tracking all the PSYOPs. She's the one that came and found Peter and took him away in that van in the first issue. And Ingrid's saying that these three renegades followed Rachel Hobson to one of the safe houses in Washington. They ambushed her, and Pete performed an invasive extraction on her mind. And she's flying back here, and I'm told she's not well. So we see the look on Harada's face. Clearly, he's concerned. And Ingrid goes on to say, and she also found out there's a box of Harbinger uniforms missing, for whatever that's worth. So a few hours later, in the PSYOT psychiatric containment ward, Ingrid is imploring Harada to go easy on Rachel. She's been through a lot, and she's going to need to go through extensive psych reconstruction. And so as the doors open, Harada's surprised by what he sees. The psych ward here doesn't look like what it should look like. It looks like a rundown mental hospital. And Ingrid said, yeah, Pete implanted this psychic impression of Joseph Irons in Rachel's consciousness. It's the state hospital where Pete and Joe first met. And Rachel's now projecting it. This is where she lives in her mind. This is where she lives. When she opens her eyes, this is what she sees. And Ingrid only takes a few steps in and says, you're going to have to excuse my weakness, sir. I'm not going to follow you in. I'm still so raw after my own exposure to Pete's mind. And Harada says, you know, of course, I won't be long. And as Harada walks in, he hears a voice actually say, hey, yo, over here. And it's actually Joseph, to who he greets. And Joseph says, she's this way, man. Come take a look. And when Harada does reach Rachel, ah, man, she is messed up. And Joe's talking about what a great friend she is. They hang out all the time. And Rachel can barely talk. She's stammering to Harada that Pete went inside her head. And Harada doesn't answer her out loud, but rather in her head, tries to calm her, and then says, I'm going to give you a brief temporal episodic memory spasm that will take you back to Pete's attack. So he's making her relive it. You know, if there's any doubt that Harada's a bad guy, I mean, she clearly is messed up. She's clearly stuck in her own head, living this hell she's in a straitjacket. She's in a rundown mental hospital in her own mind. She's clearly trapped. And Harada's like, ah, calm down. But let me take you back to the attack. So we see Peter there instead of Harada. And Pete's saying, show me, Rachel. Show me about the Harbinger Foundation. And Rachel's whispering, not again. And Harada again trying to soothe her, saying, Pete can't hurt you. It's just like watching a movie. I want to know what he saw. And so Rachel says, well, the full list of potential latents, everyone we're monitoring. And then he dug deeper. He knows about the monk. And so that you would think that would be enough, right? Harada would say, okay, I know what he knows. But no, he says, good, Rachel, but we're not done yet. I'm looking through your eyes now. The moment he disengaged, focus on Peter and Hathaway. I want to see how he interacts. I want to see the girl genius and her angry boy. And what Harada sees is he sees Chris saying, that's enough, Pete. She's wrecked. Let her go. And Pete, he's kind of a little bit in his own head telling Rachel, you knew all along they were going to kill Joe. You pretended to be my friend. Well, Pete wants a little vengeance. He wants a little justice. And so he tells Rachel, remember everything I ever knew about him. Live with Joe for the rest of your life. So that's basically why Rachel has this vision, has this projection, why she's living in this mental hospital where Joe and Pete first met, why Joe is this projection of Joe is telling Harada, yeah, she's my best friend. We hang out all the time. Like Rachel is trapped in a prison of her own mind. She's pretty much had enough at this point. She screams, ah, get out of my head. And Harada reassures her, it's okay. You've done well. Now we know what Peter's after. he's looking to activate other Psi-Ots. So not a big surprise based on what we saw last issue that that Chris is really the one calling the shots, and she knows they need more than just the three of them. We move on to La Place, New Orleans, Louisiana. 2 weeks later, we see a redhead walking along the road, and we see someone pull up in a car next to her, trying to talk to her. She can't hear anything. She's got her headphones in, so the word balloons are blank. And the guy gets out of the car. Apparently, his name is Huxley. Grabs her by her kind of the scruff of her sweatshirt, yells at her, "Can't you hear me when I'm calling you? What did I say about leaving the apartment without telling me?" And gives her a slap as she's trying to tell him that, you know, "I told you I work tonight," and she's interrupted by this slap. And this scumbag is saying, "Go ahead, talk back to me again, do it." And we get some exposition from the girl saying, "Don't look at me right now. This is me weak. I don't want you to think of me as weak." And the guy's asking for all the cash that she made last night. And she's saying, I didn't bring it. It's in my panty drawer. And this guy, I mean, just a total scumbag, saying, "Oh, you hid it from me, huh? You sneaky little." And as he walks away, he says, "I might need to get me a different woman here soon, Charlene. You keep acting this way." And, you know, I don't blame her for thinking this. I'd be thinking the same thing. "Please, God, let him leave me. Because I know if I leave him, he'll kill me." I'd be like, "Yeah, go find another woman. Leave me alone, you freaking abusive piece of garbage." So as he gets in the car, he says, "Make some money tonight, shaking that ass, rent's due, and you best not come home late." And she says, "Well, thanks for the ride, jerk," because she's still not actually at work. She's still on her way. And we get more exposition from the girl saying, "Don't look at me, not when I'm like this," as she heads to a strip club, apparently, called Bottoms Up. And as we turn the page, we see her dancing on the pole, and she's saying, "Now you can look at me." And we get the announcer saying, "Gentlemen on the main stage, it's Flamingo," and there's some flashback insets here in sepia tone, so we know this is her when she was little. She says, "You can look at this too. This is me at 12 and 13, and she's setting fires. And she says, "Yeah, don't worry about the barn. It was abandoned. The law wasn't cool with it, though." And she says, "But of course, all of that feels a million miles from here." And we're back to the present. She's sitting in a booth with another of the girls that works at the strip club, watching the fire burn from a lighter. And the girl's saying, "Yo, stop wasting my lighter." Meanwhile, we see Faith, Chris, and Pete show up at the strip club. Pete's got his arm in a sling. They're looking around. They're wondering who it is they're looking for. And Pete says, "You know, I'm not exactly sure who we're looking for yet." So they settle down at a table, and Rachel notices that Pete is staring at her. And Charlene, or Flamingo, notices that Pete is staring at her. She says, "Man, that kid's really scoping me out. I think I'm going to go talk to them." And her friend says, "Good luck getting paid. That's the strangest table there I've ever seen. I mean, they look like kids." You know, Faith has goggles on her head and a trench coat on to hide her superhero costume. And Chris doesn't exactly look like the kind to be in a strip club, right? So Charlene or Flamingo walks over and asks if they want company. And Faith remarks on how pretty she is. Chris responds with, "Sure, sit. What's observation without interaction? Bad data, I say." And Flamingo says, I don't know what that means, but I'll take it." And Chris, clearly something wrong here. That she doesn't want to be there, or she's looking down on the people that are there. Her response is, "Well, there goes your working your way through law school theory." And Flamingo thinks, "Man, what a bitch." And she introduces herself to Chris, saying she's Flamingo. And again, Chris can't help but interject and saying, "Seriously, Flamingo, that's your stage name? What is this, Vegas in the 50s? Clearly, Charlene Flamingo senses the hostility. She says, "Right, got it. You're better than me. Sorry I bothered you." And she starts to get up. And Pete grabs her by the wrist and says, "Wait, it's cool. We're just a little on edge. We've never done this before. I'm Peter and you're Charlene Dupree." We see in the background that one of the bouncers is noticing that Pete has grabbed Charlene's wrist. And she thinks, "Well, wait, how did he know my name? I should totally deny it. But there seems to be something about him, something about his sad eyes." She sits back down. She wants to know, "Okay, what's going on? You don't look like a juvie PO, you know, a juvenile parole officer." And Chris rolls her eyes saying, "Oh, wow, this just gets better and better. This chick's on parole, or probation, rather." And again, Flamingo's not going to stand for it. He says, "Hey, you better slow your roll, chick, or this is going to get real." And Chris is actually impressed by that. She's like, slow your roll. It turns out there is something interesting in there. And Faith is trying to get them to calm down. She's saying, hey, chill out. Just tell her how awesome this is going to be. We're going to change her life. And Charlene's like, oh my God, you're from my mama's church, aren't you? And Pete says, no, you know what? Let me just show you. And he touches her shoulder. He leans in. His eyes start to glow. And Charlene's thinking, I don't know what this guy's doing to me right now, but all of a sudden I feel this heat rising in me, like I haven't felt in a long time. It's flushing my face. And then we see the bouncer show up saying, hey, Grabby, don't touch the girls. That's the second time. You're out of here. And so he starts shepherding Pete and Chris to the door. Pete's apologizing to Charlene, saying that was stupid. Forget it. But as they're being escorted out, Faith, again, being Faith, not going to give up hope, saying, look, I know it's weird, and Chris is really being a total C word right now, but you got to meet us outside. It's really important. I can't stress this enough. So as Faith hurries off to catch up with Pete and Chris, Charlene's sort of sitting there dazed, thinking about what it felt like to have Pete touch her and how it's awakening all the memories in her, all the small town Romeos that she left behind. And we get more flashbacks of Charlene clearly always getting attention from the guys, 17 and making out underneath the bleachers, 18 and being out in a field somewhere doing the dirty deed with somebody in the back of a pickup truck, and getting a reputation for evil ways, right? And getting around. The last panel on the page we see is her parents arguing, saying, I mean, oh my God, Nora, our daughter's a slut. And she said, no, don't you dare say it. Don't you dare say that. And Charlene's just thinking about how all she ever did was give her parents a tough time since the day it was born. And so the small town talk got so bad that she up and left. She just couldn't take the rumors, you know. Again, it goes to a little bit of Josh exploring that gender inequality. A guy, you know, in high school, the same kind of thing, gets around, has sex, becomes sexually active at a young age, and he's hailed as a hero among his peers, right? But a woman who's aware of her sexuality and does the same gets labeled as loose or a slut, or she gets a bad reputation. So right or wrong, it's just reality. So Josh is giving us some of that reality here. And so we see that Charlene chose to leave, and she hitchhiked her way out of her small town. And I'm sure she had no problems getting a ride, because this is an incredible page by Barry Kitson. We see an 18-wheeler, which is rendered very, very well with detail. And Charlene herself is looking pretty good from a male perspective, with her jeans, her cutoff jeans that are cut off so short you can see the pockets below the jeans themselves, with a little tied up top sticking out her thumb. And again, I'm sure she had no problems getting a ride. And it's not surprising that that she ended up where she did, unfortunately. So she's kind of reliving that, sitting at the bar, thinking she headed to the big city where she could use or leverage her newfound power over men and over her own body. You know, she'd always been able to manipulate guys because of her looks and her body and her sexuality. But now all of a sudden it feels different. She doesn't feel like herself, and it's that touch. She can't get it out of her head. She can't say exactly why, but she decides she's going to go outside and find that boy with the sad eyes. So when she goes out there, they're still arguing. And as far as she can tell, it's about getting them to join her. So she's thinking foursome. And Chris is telling Pete, really? You think I care she's a stripper? It's not her. It's you. And Pete's like, well, Chris, what do you mean? I get it. I'm living with it. But it's not like that. I saw what's in her head. She's lost. I think we can help her. And Faith notices that Charlene is standing there listening to them and says, wait, she's here. And so Charlene walks up, says, hi, y'all. And Faith implores Peter, go ahead, ask her. And so Pete says, Charlene, will you come with me back to our hotel room? So again, this kind of question is not going to show Charlene that it's anything different than what she thinks it is, right? They're looking to party. They're looking to have some kind of foursome. On the next page, we get another flashback, and it's Charlene when she first got to New Orleans, finally free of the small town prison, as she says. And we get a panel of her meeting Huxley, the guy that was slapping around at the beginning of the issue. Charlene talks about how it was kind of different with Huxley. Up until that point, she'd sort of taken all the boys and the girls that she'd been with, but Huxley really took her, and it felt good at first, right, to kind of let go, to not be the one in charge making the decisions. But after 3 months, Huxley's got her trying to do porn, which is something she was not into, and she feels like that's when she started to lose pieces of herself. Huxley started to take her joy. And then 6 months after she met him, she was being beaten. And she thinks about how love can't spell unkind, is what her her mama used to say. And we also see in the foreground, as Huxley's whipping her with a belt, some drug paraphernalia, some cocaine, some like a crack pipe. And clearly Charlene's in over her head. So in the final panel on that page, we see Charlene standing there next to Peter saying, "This is me waiting to go home to Huxley so he can take more and more of me till I'm all used up." So it kind of explains why Charlene would go with Pete, would agree, even if he does want some kind of foursome with her, because at least it's the possibility of a way out, right? At least it's something different. It's better than going home so Huxley can take more pieces of her. So when they get to the hotel, Faith and Chris are waiting outside. Chris is smoking, and Faith is pretty surprised by that, saying, "I didn't know you smoked." And Chris says, "Only when I'm freaked out." And I love the response from Faith. She says, "Wow, and you're just now lighting up? Crazy, like everything they've been through, and now you're freaked out?" And so Faith goes on to say, "You know, I was thinking, isn't what you're asking Pete to do here with Charlene the same as him dragging you into all this mess?" And it's really kind of an insightful question for Faith. It's not that Faith is unintelligent, but she usually – she doesn't bring up topics that are like that that big, right? I mean, that's a big question, and it cuts right to the center of this dilemma that they're sort of in. And Chris says, "Jesus, Faith, I like it better when you talk about Doctor Who." And Faith says, "You know, well, Doctor Who is awesome, and look, it's I think it's cool what we're doing, because this has been the best thing that ever happened to me. But I guess I just don't understand why you're cool with it." And Chris is like, "You know, I don't really have an answer for you, because you're right in a way. We're conscripting human beings into something they can't possibly be prepared for." And then she goes on to say, "But as a famous douchebag once said, you don't go to war with the army you want." Know what I mean? Obviously, Faith doesn't. And the quote's actually from Donald Rumsfeld, and it was something like, "You don't go to war with the army you want. You go to war with the army you have." So that's a pretty apt description, you know, regardless of who said it. They're making do with the best that they have. I mean, they're kids. They don't have the resources or the power that Harada does. And so they're kind of left with no choice in a way. And Faith doesn't really understand what that means either. But we move on to seeing that Pete and Charlene are in the hotel room. And she's like, it's just the two of us then? I guess I was expecting all three of you. And Pete says, I think maybe you got the wrong idea. And Charlene says, really? Because you look pretty nervous. And Pete says, yeah, well, because I'm not really sure about the next part. It didn't exactly go real well when he activated Faith. In fact, I think he thought that he had hurt her in a way, and it wasn't even clear that he had activated her at all. And so Charlene's asking Pete, you're not going to hurt me, are you? And he says, well, I hope not. But can I put my hand on you before? Is that like I did before? Is that cool? And she says, oh, yeah, baby, that felt good. And as Pete does, Charlene closes her eyes. Pete's eyes start to glow. He's telling her to clear her mind. And Charlene is thinking about how nice it is to have the warm touch on her face. But then the friction starts building, and it's getting hotter and hotter. And all of a sudden, it's like she's on fire, and it's burning her alive. It's every song she ever danced to, every hit she ever took from Huxley, everything in her life, good and bad, all of it, all the fire. And as we turn the page, we see this splash with Charlene throwing her head back, Pete kind of falling back as Charlene opens her mouth, and there's just this torrent of flame that comes out. So Pete has to bring up a psionic shield to protect himself, and he's telling Charlene to take her hand. He can get her out of there, and Charlene's telling him to get away, don't touch her, and she's burning up now. Her whole body's alight, the room's ablaze. As Faith and Chris are watching from below, Pete comes flying through the wall in a big explosion, and we see the motel or hotel, whatever it is, start to collapse around Charlene and go up in flames. So we turn the page. We're back at the Bottoms Up parking lot, And Huxley's yelling, saying, "There you are. I'm going to rip you up. You know how long I've been waiting." And as Charlene walks closer, he sees that her whole body, except for her hair, it looks gray. And she's covered in some kind of soot or ash. And Huxley, it stops him in mid-sentence. He's like, "Oh my God, what the hell, girl?" And she says, "It's okay, Huxley, the pain, the fire, it's starting to go away." And she's thinking to herself, how I could have survived that. And Huxley's saying, "Oh my gosh, you're burning up. Get in the car. We got to get you off the street." Charlene's not even sure how she got there, but she is telling Huxley, "Well, you're trying to be sweet to me. Sometimes you try to be that sweet. And it's so nice." She gets in the car with Huxley. She's thinking, "What do I really know about fire?" So Ever the tough guy, Huxley's talking about finding out whoever did this, whoever did this to my lady, I'll knock their balls in with a freaking hammer. Tell me who it was. And Charlene's response is, well, it was you, Huxley. You took away my heat. But listen, I think I just got it back." And she reaches between his legs and sets him on fire, sets the car on fire. And she's talking about the fact that she knows that fire needs heat and combustion. But the thing that it also needs is it needs to breathe, right? Like it's alive. And she's thinking that she's hot too, and she breathes. And maybe she hasn't been able to breathe because Huxley's been suffocating her. So he's screaming, talking about his junk being on fire, asking for help. And Charlene says, "You know, I know it hurts. It hurts so bad. And, you know, I felt it. I burned and burned." And, you know, nobody was there to help her. And so Huxley kind of runs off into the night. And Charlene saying that she's never felt more alive. And as she says that, the car explodes. We see Zephyr flying above, and she's telling him they're telepathically linked. She's telling Peter that she's seen an explosion in the strip club parking lot. She's going in. Charlene is once again saying that we can look at her now. And Faith kind of hovers in and asks if she's okay. And Flamingo looks up and says, "You can fly?" And Faith responds, "Yeah, it's pretty dope." And Charlene seems to take it in stride, right? I mean, she can light fire. She just survived a fire. So I guess she's not too surprised. And she asks Faith if anyone got hurt in the motel fire. And Faith tells her, "No, don't worry. Pete woke everyone up with a psychic scream and Chris pulled the fire alarm. Nobody saw them. They're totally superheroes." And so Faith asks what happened there. And Charlene's response is, "Oh, don't worry about that. That ain't nothing but a freedom fire." Interesting origin for Flamingo. As I was talking about last issue with some of the themes that Josh was exploring in 2012, they're irrelevant. The haves, the have-nots, the Great Recession, and housing and medical costs and all that kind of stuff. And the divisiveness, the divides that were starting to be formed. And I was talking about how it's just as relevant, if not more relevant now. I feel kind of the same way about this issue. You know, we're talking about things like gender inequality. You know, I mentioned earlier about a guy in high school is promiscuous and he's kind of can be hailed as a hero, whereas a girl is looked down upon for that. We can talk about things like the physical abuse, which is very topical today. And so I don't know that Josh thought when he was writing this that it would be just as important in 2019 or just as talked about or relevant in 2019 as it was in 2012 or 2013 when he wrote it. But it's pretty interesting that these topics are even more at the forefront now. So you can argue whether or not what Charlene did was right. I mean, we don't really see that Huxley dies. So, I mean, that's the assumption I would make. The guy was on fire, but whether or not right or wrong, whether that makes her a hero, I mean, that's all up for debate. But it certainly seems like she took back something of herself. You know, she mentioned that fire needs to breathe. She hasn't been able to breathe in a long time because Huxley's been the one there kind of suffocating her. And so I feel like of all the renegades, she's the one that we kind of know the least about in terms of kind of what's under the surface, but I feel like she's one of the ones that maybe has the most under the surface. So we do explore that a little bit, and what happened with her and Huxley, what happens in this issue does come back, and it kind of stays with Charlene a little bit. So that'll be explored a little more. The other thing I like about this issue, it's one of those comics that makes you think. You know, I mean, the whole Harbinger story by Joshua Dysart really does that. It's part of the reason I love it so much. And the question that Faith asked Chris about, are they doing the right thing in basically bringing these people into their war against Harada, without telling them and without them having any way to understand what they're getting into. But again, they don't really necessarily have a choice. You've got to fight the fight. You've got to fight the war with the army that you have, not the army that you wish you had. So again, there's not really a choice when it comes to it, when it comes down to it. So the other thing about Charlene joining the Renegades, it does change the dynamic. She's got her own opinions. You know, she may not be completely informed about Harada and what he's up to, but each time you add another member to the Renegades, you're adding in another person, another, you know, independent person with all their thoughts. And it does change the dynamics and the relationships of how the Renegades relate to each other. So you've got that to navigate as well. And the other thing to consider is these are very young people. They may not make the best choices. They may not have the most informed choices because they don't have that much experience. So ultimately, with what happens with the Renegades and bringing them in, Charlene, and then later on Torque, without them really understanding what they're getting involved in, is it the right choice or not? Hindsight's 20/20. Things don't exactly work out great for the Renegades, so you can say that it was the wrong choice, but given the path that Charlene was on, and if you were to tell her what was eventually going to happen, I think she might still make this choice. She might still choose to have the freedom, at least to live her life without being under the thumb of Huxley. But again, there's no way to really know. But again, it does make for an interesting story. And at some point, I'd love to have a Flamingo solo series and explore a little more about who Charlene is and explore some of the depth there. I'm just not sure on the timing of it, when you could fit it in, when you could make it work. But she is a character who I feel like I don't know enough about in terms of kind of motivations and feelings and thoughts. I feel like there's a lot more there on the surface than just the kind of flirtatious, pretty face that she kind of puts forward, even as she joins the Renegades. So one other quick thing I'll mention, I did let you all know that Barry Kitson and Lee Garbett did the majority of the art on this book. And I really like the clean lines and the emotion. And for my money, nobody draws a Flamingo better than Barry Kitson. Even when she's covered in ash at the end, the final panel where she's telling Faith it's nothing but a freedom fighter, it is gorgeous. She just, Kitson just has her down perfectly. So I really enjoyed the art in this issue. I think that's going to do it for this episode. Hope you all enjoyed it as always. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.